Tamara Thomas, Editor-in-Chief of UrbanHealthToday.com, part of the DocWire family of medical news sites, and I want to thank you for tuning in to Urban Health Weekly. Our goal each week is to keep you informed of the latest in health and medical news right from today's headlines. It's time to empower yourself with open conversations about your medical care with news that matters to you. So are you ready? Let's get started. Hey, welcome to Urban Health Weekly. I'm here with my friend Lou, and we are about to get started on today's show. So I had to tell you about this podcast that I started listening to.
Okay.
And I don't know if I'm going to continue listening to it, but I just, you know, one episode, it's called the Black Goddess Podcast. Mm-hmm. And it caught my eye because one of the episodes was about, it's called the Big Booty Pandemic.
Oh, okay. Now you have my attention.
And so they were talking about all these women who seem to be coming back from the Dominican Republic with BBL, which is the Brazilian butt lift. Mm. And I just thought that was hilarious because, like, you know, I was talking to a friend the other day who was in, I think it was motor vehicles or someplace. And she was saying that everyone around her has like this big old booty. And I'm like, is this what people are doing with the relief money? Going to Dominican Republic and going to the doctor and getting
so
the Brazilian
butt lift.
So basically
only the flight attendant knows for sure. I mean, small booty going in, big booty coming back.
They're probably coming back with pillows because you can't sit on it. Like once you have to stay off your butt. So I mean, I'm not even really sure if they have to stay there a length of time or something like that. But you have to sit on a pillow or something like that. Otherwise, you're going to deform the work, like because you can't sit on it for several weeks.
Okay. Well, before we get into this topic too much, let me read through my contract and see what I can and can't say about these things.
Oh, for heaven's sake, just say what you have to say.
Well,
I know you like to see those big donkey booties.
Me?
I've seen you looking at those big old, yes.
Me in the street?
Yes.
First of all.
You have no decorum.
Aside from the health
you have
aspects,
no decorum when it
they
comes
cause
to
traffic accidents.
No, people, they don't.
Men crane and look, and all of a sudden, boom, and
that's
and
true.
Your
that, is, that is true. That's true.
So,
isn't that why men's premiums are higher because they tend to get into more accidents?
Exactly, because we're looking at it at BBL recipients.
Well, it's not
that said. I've always wondered what kind of, you know, what it is that's injected back there and what are the effects?
So,
and, you know, it's obviously not being done in the United States, so there's no regulation.
Well, for the most part, what a Brazilian butt lift is, technically is, you have fat suctioned out of other parts of your body, say like your back or your arms or your thighs, and basically removed from undesirable places. Mm-hmm. And then they're injected. They're you know, they do some process to it, clean it up, whatever. And then they use it and inject it into strategically into your backside and your hips to give you a more rounded derriere, lifted butt and, you know, rounder hips. Mm. But there are some people who go the cheap route and do the silicone where they basically, it's like, you know, you ever look at a side of beef and you see like the swirls of fat within it? That's called marbling.
Okay.
And basically what they're doing is they're getting this like industrial grade stuff marbled into their gluteal muscles and such. And from what I understand, like I was reading Keisha Cole's accounts of like, because Keisha Cole had that done and she's just had numerous surgeries. Mm-hmm. And I've seen on Real Self where some girls go through having it removed. It's basically like removing shotgun pellet throughout your behind. It's like multiple surgeries to remove that stuff because it creates such damage. You know, some women have strokes. Just all kinds of embolisms, all kinds of health problems. But the other thing that I got to thinking when I was thinking about that whole thing was, I was thinking like, what does this do for doctors now? How do they check how healthy you are? Mm-hmm. Because now your hip to waist ratio is off because you've artificially changed it. So there's no real accounting of, you know, of how healthy you are. If you had an apple shape before, which is associated with, because a pear shape A pear shape is healthier, an apple shape is less healthy. If you were previously an apple shaped person, and you went and surgically had yourself turned into a pear, what kind of position does that put the doctor in being able to assess your health risks and stuff?
Do you know what I mean? Like, this is not being done by doctor. Look,
the other stuff, the industrial stuff, that's correct. That's not being done by doctors. And that stuff is not approved by the FDA. But I'm just saying, regardless of which one you do, whether you do, I mean, obviously with the silicone one, if that even is silicone, you're obviously running a lot more immediate risks.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying long-term in reshaping your body like that, you don't genetically, it doesn't change your genes. It just changes how you look on the outside. It doesn't really change your health risk. It doesn't really change. And I'm just wondering how this turns medicine on its head in terms of being able to assess people's health.
Well, I'll share here a bit. I had a friend, a platonic friend, that actually went through the procedure, and she was proud of the procedure. Exactly, she said, "I got a doctor." She went to the Brand X way of doing
it. What do you mean she went to the Brand X?
What's
the
Brand X? Non-physician and use the silicone.
No.
Yeah, and use the silicone. And
she told you this?
Yeah, she told us this. Yeah, she was nice enough to share. I mean, she was very proud of it. It was a group setting.
Okay.
And, the conversation was going on. But she also shared that she now could only sleep on her front, on her face. She could not sleep on her back because of the discomfort, because of how solid it was.
Uh-huh.
It almost felt like, everybody was kind of like poking it and touching it. And I'm telling you, it felt like a suit of armor back there.
Oh, my God.
And, I guess.
She let you touch her butt?
Yeah. Or the new butt. I mean, everybody was touching her. Like,
I almost missed that part.
I was wondering when that was going to come. That's why I checked my contract carefully before I started.
Just go ahead.
Anyway, it just felt hard. I mean, it did not feel like a natural thing. It felt like you were touching like something through a suit of clothes or something.
So if you had to compare it to like, say, a football, a basketball, a helium balloon, like where in the spectrum? I myself have never touched one of these behinds.
It felt metallic. It's very hard to describe, but it didn't have the give that you would expect to human flesh.
Uh-huh.
It's almost like touching a mannequin.
That's
kind of what it felt like. It wasn't huge, but it was bigger than what it was. It was somebody who was already endowed and decided to become, let's accentuate our positives, let's say.
Wow.
And the first unintended consequences that she was having at that time.
Is that she can no longer sleep on her back.
That she could no longer sleep. She was starting to get backaches because of posture. It was a problem because anytime she would sleep, sitting became uncomfortable. And natural things that you do, we all sit the same way. We all grow the same way. If you've ever watched a kid.
No, we don't all grow the same way, but okay. I know what you mean. Yeah.
What I'm saying is as a child grows, they have areas or times in their lives where they're a little awkward.
Right.
And that's because they've done a growth spurt. They get used to their bodies.
Right.
You're going to have to get used to this new body.
Yeah.
There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Now, as an adult, you don't have the suppleness of a child. You're not still growing all the time and all that. Once you have something like this, it could lead to back pain. It could lead to some other chronic conditions.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you're going to be carrying more weight. You're going to be carrying an extra 10 to 20
And that's pounds. What I'm talking about. I'm talking about now that you've enhanced your body this way and you've reshaped yourself, how does a doctor then assess you for health risks? That's my concern. Like, I think women should be able to do what they want with their bodies. I think they should do what makes them happy and makes them feel sexy. Hey, go off. You know, like, I'm certainly no stranger to getting, work done. I went on a consultation with this doctor. I wanted to get liposuction. And the doctor said to me, he says, "Well, after I remove the fat, where do you want me to put it?" And I was like, "What?" He was like, "Where do you want me to put it?" And he's like scanning me with his eyes, like hoping that I'm like, in the trash. I don't want it back in my body. I want it gone. Keep it. So he just kept asking me all like unexpectedly, like, and where should I put it? Like, you know, I thought he was gonna say, "Do you want me to put it in your butt?" Because he kept like scanning my body, like, like, "Do you want me to?" And he said, "I hate to waste good fat." I was like, "Well, so anyway, suffice it to say, I did not do the procedure, but I just thought that was funny that that's how plastic surgeons think now. It's like, well, we got to put this fat to use. It doesn't just go into the landfill or anymore. It was pretty funny.
Anyway, for those of you that are considering doing some of that, please do it safely. Please consult an MD.
Yes, please go to the DR.
And please consult with others that have done it the right way and the wrong way.
Actually, it's probably best if you go to Miami. That I've heard that Miami does the best Brazilian butt lifts. I think there's one doctor here in New York that really is like the king of it. I can't remember his name. But in any event, I'm hearing that Miami is the place to be.
It's becoming so prevalent.
Yeah. But anyway, I'm sad to say that experts are predicting a measles outbreak for this year. Can you imagine 22 million babies missed their vaccines during the pandemic? 22 million babies. My God.
Wow.
So the CDC and the WHO are warning about the potential threat of measles after more than 22 million babies across the world missed the first dose of their measles vaccination during the height of the pandemic. The report, which was published online ahead of the CDC's November 12th Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report Journal, notes that these infants missed their first dose of the measles vaccine last year, which is 3 million more missed doses than in 2019. And it's also the largest annual increase in over 20 years of unvaccinated children. I'm not really sure what to say about this one, except that I'm pleading with mothers to get vaccinated and please keep up with your baby's vaccines. Babies are not getting COVID, adults are.
And here in New York, in New York City, particularly in Brooklyn, we had a small microcosm of that. Because remember, no vaccine is 100% effective.
Right.
So the measles vaccine, whatever their effectiveness is, I forget, it's 80, 90%. It's rather effective. Mm-hmm. Once everybody was supposed to get it, that was fine. Measles was basically stamped out of the New York City system.
Right.
You rarely had a case.
And then you had the anti-vax movement.
You had the anti-vaxxers.
Then you had
outbreaks. Well, it was one community. I'm going to name them. The
Hasidic, I wish you wouldn't.
But I will. The Hasidic community here in New York. It's okay. Look, people can look it up.
I mean, it's
decided
true, but
for whatever reason that they weren't going to get it. Okay.
Yeah.
So you would think this will stay in their community.
But didn't this also happen? It also happened in Disney World in California, right? There was another
outbreak over there.
But and I don't think that was driven by, so like let's no, not make they, it sound
no,
like
no, this
it
is
was,
not them, but I'm just saying a right. microcosm of what can happen.
It basically what you're trying to say, I'm trying to clean this up for you a little bit.
Okay.
Is that the unvaccinated population, which may include some Hasidic communities,
right? But
have opted not to vaccinate, and it has resulted in pockets of measles outbreaks across the country.
So, what started happening in New York City was, you know, a lot of non-vaxxers in mass.
So you're still going with this,
okay. Go with it.
Okay.
Then,
all right.
Kids mix together in the playground. They don't stay within their groups. Kids are kids. They play together. Kids started playing together in the playgrounds. Mm-hmm. The disease started spreading rampantly across the city. And all of a sudden, about 3 years ago, we had a pretty big outbreak of measles. And it's like, hey, all it takes is one group, whatever that group is. And believe me, every group is guilty of something. So I'm not shaming them for that. I'm just saying what the story was. If a concentrated group doesn't vaccinate, mm-hmm. and right now we've got 22 million, which let's call these a concentrated age group. If these kids don't catch up on their vaccines, this is going to be a concentrated group that's going to hit the schools in about 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen is we're going to start getting a lot of breakouts of measles, chickenpox, rubella.
Yeah, mumps. All these childhood diseases that we stamped out with vaccinations are now falling by the wayside.
But what I'm getting at is when I was a kid in the 60s, there wasn't a measles vaccine. There wasn't a chickenpox vaccine. Mm-hmm. And we had all the crazy stuff. We had the chickenpox parties. So when one kid would get it, everybody would.
Oh my God! I remember something like that when I was coming up. It was chickenpox, where people would, like, one kid would have the chickenpox, yeah, and everyone, mm-hmm, would poke at the blister and rub it on themselves so that they can get it.
I mean, the dumbest.
I know. I never participated. I thought it was dumb even back then.
I got them all except for rubella and German measles. And being that I missed that window for vaccination, I worry every time there's a measles outbreak. I go, Jesus.
Okay, too late to get the shot. Yeah,
can I get it? I got to look into that. Can an adult get it?
You can get measles if that's what you're asking.
For chicken pox, there's the shingles, which I'm going to get that. But I did get the chicken pox as a kid, and I did get the mumps. Mm-hmm. I didn't get the other two. And I'm just wondering, what can I do now? So that's something that's a to-do list that I'm going to do after the show today.
Yeah, you should really see about getting that. Yeah. All right. Early signs of stroke you need to know, even if you're young. So like with many other health concerns, your risk of having a stroke increases as you get older. In fact, every 10 years after age 55, your stroke risk nearly doubles, according to the American Stroke Association. So let's talk about some of these weird symptoms that you should be looking for. So things you should be looking for: a sudden onset of dizziness or severe headache. A most prominent stroke warning in women under 45, sometimes accompanied by hiccups or nausea, if you can believe it. A pinched nerve feeling or a tweak of some sort, some sort of neck pain. You feel like you might've gotten a crook in your neck. Loss of language. And changes in vision, strength, or sensation. Symptoms that are totally uncharacteristic for you, or they're associated with neck pain or a recent fall. If you're worried, you should obviously call 911. And if your doctor tries to diagnose you with something else, because a lot of doctors, don't want to believe if you're under a certain age that you could possibly have a stroke, they'll think it's something like an inner ear infection or a migraine. Don't give up. A migraine won't kill you, but a stroke may, points out Dr. Liebskin. Another doctor, Dr. Newman Toker, suggests asking the doctor this question: why do you think it's not a stroke? And if the doctor can't give you an answer that sounds halfway intelligible, speak to another doctor. So what do we think about this?
Well,
I wonder if I had a stroke last year. I know, maybe I'm, yeah. I mean, I did have that dizziness,
yeah,
where I was really... It was really ataxic.
I think the first thing about stroke is, from my just small exposure to it, the people that have strokes rarely know that they're having one, mm-hmm, and will even argue with you that they're not having a stroke. They didn't have a stroke.
But who knows what a stroke really feels like? Because they have such a vast array of symptoms. You just don't know.
It doesn't know. All you know is an observer. So the observer has to be extra vigilant. So if you feel that somebody had a stroke and any of these signs are present, either facial expression is not...
like the most classic sign is when you've got the slowed down speech, mm-hmm, face droop, or, mm-hmm, weakness in, on one side of your body. Those are the classic symptons that people know. But a lot of people don't know about the other symptoms, like headaches.
Or just going to sleep, or a mild loss of consciousness where you can't be awoken, and then all of a sudden you wake up and you think you're fine. That's what happened to my dad. My dad actually turned 90 years old today.
God bless.
Happy birthday. He had a stroke, a small stroke, a very minor stroke, about 2-3 years ago. And my mother was trying to rouse him, and she thought he was dead. She called me on the phone. I think your father's dead. She was all alarmed. I told her, what am I going to do? She said, well, come here. And I said, well, call 911. What am I going to do?
He said, what am I going to do?
Exactly. What am I going to do? He's dead already. It's like, there's nothing I can do. So she said, he's non-responsive.
What do you want me to do?
So I said, well, my work, call 911 and I'm going to get there. Now, there is a little subtext here. I figured since he was already dead, I left work. when I had breakfast.
Oh my God.
So I didn't show up until 3 hours later.
Oh my God.
I figured by then they'd get rid of the body or whatever. Anyway, I get there and I hear all sorts of Latin curse words as only my father put them together. And, you know, I'm walking up, he's supposed to be dead. Why do I see
you're disappointed that he was alive?
I wasn't disappointed. The man is supposed to be dead.
It sounded like you were disappointed that your father survived.
So I'm walking up the stairs and I hear all sorts of nasty curses and all that. So what happened was no one could rise when he was just completely out, gone. Non-responsive, it seemed, for all intents and purposes.
For how long?
For about 15 minutes.
Oh, okay. So that was short.
Fire department gets there, and they all of a sudden he comes to, you know, hey, risen from the dead. So he comes to, and wondering why they're there, because in his mind there was no lapse of time.
Oh wow!
In his mind he was talking.
It's like anesthesia.
Yeah,
almost.
And then all of a sudden fire people are there, and he's like, "What is going on here?"
Right, right.
So, to make a long story short. You know, they roused him and all that. And then he was excited and saying that he's cursing at everybody for calling the fire department. He's yelling at me for me showing up, and all this.
What's
and
the big fuss about? What is wrong with you people?
Yeah, he was almost like, you two are showing up here, you know, after he threw the fire people out. And then, of course, he you know, they did look at him. He had a small stroke. All the symptoms did go away. And
wow, that's incredible. An incredible story.
But
I'm not sure which is more shocking, that he had a stroke and then he didn't realize that he had a stroke at all, or that you were disappointed that your father survived the stroke.
I think the worst part is that I went and had breakfast. Now I know, like,
and had breakfast because you were hoping they would clear the body.
He was 88. I was just hungry. And I just said, this is going to be a long day. You know,
I need some fuel.
I need some food before I can deal with this.
Another stroke symptom that that a lot of people are not aware of is a blinding headache, a headache that feels like the worst headache you've ever had in your life. It feels like a migraine. If you're not diagnosed with a migraine sufferer, and then you suddenly have this blinding headache, and you're a woman, that could also potentially be a stroke. So just be on the lookout. Don't assume that because you're young that strokes can't happen to you. Now, here's something that I found really disturbing, that I had to sound the alarm, and I sent this to everybody because I was like, oh my God. So palm oil, which is a fatty acid, apparently may help cancer spread. They've done a study with mice where they injected the palmitic acid, which is what the palm oil is made of. And basically what happens is the palmitic acid of the palm oil somehow stimulates and feeds the cancer cells and enables them to metastasize through the body. And the worst part is it not only is ingesting palm oil problematic, but your cells have a memory of having the palm oil. And so it won't even stop if you stop with palm oil. I mean, that's incredible. A study has shown that palmitic acid, a fatty acid found in palm oil, which is a common ingredient in cakes, biscuits, and chocolate, can increase the metastasis or spread of cancer. According to an earlier study from 2019, more than 65% of deaths due to solid tumor cancer had metastases as a registered contributing cause. Metastasis happens when cancer cells come away from the main tumor mass and enter the blood or lymph streams, allowing them to travel and grow into tumors in other parts of the body. Let me say this. Functional medicine doctors have been shouting to the mountaintops for many years now to stay away from vegetable oils made from canola, vegetable, corn, and nut seeds. They say stick to butter, olive oil, and avocado oil. So I realized that this was done in mice, but most studies are done in mice because they can't be really done in people. You can't inject people's cancer cells with palmitic oil and watch it go. I hope this just gives people some It's so difficult though, because so many things that we like are made with these oils. Like even a lot of these health foods have, you look at the ingredients and it's like palm oil, canola oil. You can't get away from this stuff. It's really alarming. I mean, the best thing to do is just kind of make stuff, but they always say that too. The functional medicine doctors, you know, and health coaches, they're all like, make your own food. Make your own food. And I know, well, in this fast-paced world, it's very difficult to. Yeah.
Short of me, and I've got three or four comments here, but go ahead and finish your thought.
Well, just, you know, the prepping food at home where you're 100% sure what ingredients are going in.
Well, first of all, as you said, short of growing your own food in your yard.
I didn't say growing your own food.
Buying Tibetan, fish or something, you know, totally pure.
The closer you can eat something to its original source is the better. That's all. I'm not saying that, you know, you have to go to Tibet and get to, you know, like something made by a Sherpa.
You know, oil is oil, you know.
No, oil is not oil.
Oil is not oil.
There are highly processed oils like the ones that I just talked about. And there are oils that are very heart healthy and very good for you.
I get it. And I try to eat as healthy as possible. But if I'm looking at a cake face to face, or a cheesecake, or something that's delicious, and it happens to have a little bit of the oil, I'll take my chances. That's just me.
That's fine, but you're in a position that you can choose. Like, you shop at Whole Foods, so like, what are you talking about? Like,
I eat healthy, you know,
I'm just saying that you shouldn't encourage people to slack off and be like, well, food is food. I'm not
having a pack of potato chips a day, and I'm not having a pack of Doritos a day.
But there are people that do that, and when they hear you say stuff like that,
you start getting into trouble. When
but that's not what you were just saying.
No, what I'm saying is cheating here and there. I don't think the numbers are going to stack that way against you. I think that it's a concentrated.
You're right.
Effort.
If it's once in a blue moon, I'm talking about for people who eat processed food all
every
the time,
day, which you do that, see it.
And you know, going back to the whole thing with the cancer cells having a memory of exposure to the palmitic acid and remaining highly metastatic, that's not like every day. That's like just having a little bit.
Right, and when you start looking at some of the trends too. And you start saying like one of the trends that we're seeing is more and more younger and younger people are getting colon cancer, for example.
Yes.
And, you know, is it the gamma rays? Is it our gene pool? The only real logical answer that I can see, we don't know yet what's causing it.
I think researchers and scientists do know. I think they're afraid to say it and get into a lawsuit, but...
I think food,
we'll
whatever.
Say, we'll say food. That we don't know. We'll say that science doesn't know yet. They're closing in.
You know, we're talking about a GI cancer that's earlier and earlier. We're not talking about other types of cancer. We're talking about a GI cancer. The onset is younger and younger people are getting it.
Yes.
And the answer is why. And the only thing that... You know,
the way food is produced now is the problem.
Somehow, some way, that food preferences.
Not just food preferences, the choices you have in terms of prepared foods. Mm-hmm. Everything is made with a lot of with these oils because these oils are inexpensive to procure. You know, and so if you're mass producing something, or even if you're just bulk producing, you know, let's say you're a health food brand. You know, a lot of them use these palm oils and canola oils because it's just cheaper. You know, if you're selling something for, let's say, I don't know, a unit price of like $10, you know, and you want to make a profit and you want to be able to keep producing, you're going to buy the oil that's like 50 cents. I'm throwing these numbers out. I don't know exact numbers, but I'm just throwing, you know, fake numbers out there. And it only costs 50 cents to add this oil to your product, you have a profit margin versus using an oil like avocado oil, where you have to make the price like $20 and then you meet price resistance and then people don't buy your stuff.
Right.
But people will buy the whole food set, for example, are willing to spend that extra money. I'm willing to spend the extra, like I look very carefully. And if it says olive oil or avocado oil, I'm in. Like I'm not buying that other stuff just because I'm, well, partly because I'm allergic to it. You know, it's an irritant to me. It does irritate my, you know, system, but mostly because I just in general stay away from it because it's just not, it's not good for me.
Right.
So I'll pay that, but I'm an outlier. I'm not the average person in terms of, you know,
right. My health. And I would say within the last decade or so, I've really changed the way I eat. A, I'm getting older. Mm. And B, there's a lot more information out there now.
Right.
And C, there's a lot more choices and it's easily accessible.
Yeah.
I mean, when I, again, I'm going
to And I'm just saying that you, sorry to cut across you, but I'm just saying that short of spending a ransom on food, if you prepare the food yourself, it takes a little extra time, but it's much cheaper than buying the specialty stuff at whole paycheck. That's all I'm saying, you know?
So with that, you think it's time to take a break?
Time, yeah, we've got to take a break. We'll be back.
Frenchman to Oak Street, Tremaine, Gentilly, and the CBD. V102.3, WHIV-FM, the vibe of the city for human rights and social justice. WHIV, 102.3 FM.
To the next medical news. Did you know that 1 in 3 patients defer their health care due to existing medical debt? This is according to TransUnion. Mm. Almost 6 in 10 respondents to a TransUnion survey last September said they deferred non-COVID related medical care in the 6 months prior, while nearly half said the economy had at least some impact on how they approach medical care. TransUnion, so, you know, there's Equifax, Experian, TransUnion, credit reporting agencies. Latest data suggests financial concerns are factoring into patients' current decisions to delay seeking care as well. It echoes similar research released from payment technology company PatientCo, which also found that 1 in 3 patients avoided seeking health care due to cost barriers. Jonathan Wick, principal of the healthcare strategy, for TransUnion Healthcare said, "It's scary and sad to know people are foregoing their physical and mental health for fear they'll ruin their financial health with medical treatment. As many as 3 million people may have lost employer-sponsored health insurance due to COVID-19 in the early months of the pandemic, according to a Kaiser Family Foundation analysis. At the same time, enrollment in Medicaid climbed as people lost their jobs and insurance, while others obtain private coverage by signing up as dependents on a family member's plan. Amid the disruptions to coverage, many people simply put off getting care." Well, I'm not surprised to hear any of this.
I'm really sorry, because in my mind, money should never come between you and your health.
Well, that's easy for you to say, but the thing is like after, if you have limited resources, after immediate bills like rent, food, and transportation, people don't have money to see a doctor for healthcare. Now I'm with you. I agree with what you're saying. I'm just saying that, you know, when you have limited means, you have to take care of your immediate needs first. And if you have rotten teeth, let's say, that's going to take a back seat to buying food.
But if you have
a little ache or pain, you perceive it as a little ache or pain, or even if you have a big pain, that's going to take a back seat to, you have to get to work, you have to feed the kids, you have to keep the lights on, you have to keep the gas on.
True. But
you have to pay the water bill. I mean, those things, you know, come up first. And
well, they shouldn't come up first. And
I know, but some people feel like it's, you know, some people really literally feel like healthcare is just for people with money. And others are concerned that they'll be hit with like surprise bills, which is when you get a massive hospital bill.
Which, by the way,
after a health emergency
is a common practice.
Out of network care, you receive, but you were never made aware of.
It is a common practice, but you do have your rights, and surprise medical billing is actually illegal. They're not allowed to send you this surprise bill. Oh, it's $30,000.
Well, they're fighting it tooth and nail.
It's being fought tooth and nail. But
yeah,
what I'm going to say is this. We have a lot of options out there, and it's not for lack of money. In my view, it's for lack of information. a lot of people are not aware of all the free options that are available to them or low-cost options that are available to them to get well treatment or even emergency treatment. And to have a, you know that saying, an educated consumer? We are consumers of healthcare.
Oh my God, I remember that. Yeah. Sims, educated consumers are our best customer.
Exactly. And and as a healthcare, recipient.
I'm dating myself.
Right. We're all, that's my job, by the way, but we all are consumers. I'm not going to use the term educated because in a lot of instances, there isn't that education out there for, okay, we know that something is bad, but we may not spend an entire show on where to get it, how to get it. Today, we're going to do a very humble approach in talking a little bit about those options.
Well, I was going to say that this is why urgent care clinics are doing so well, because they charge like a flat, transparent rate for their care. And you're not waiting hours to see somebody and you don't have to. I remember reading, this made me really sad. I remember reading about a young lady who got her breast cancer diagnosis and she immediately went in and bought a plot because as far as she was concerned, her life was going to be over. She, you know, she didn't think about, okay, medical bills. And in fact, the form they have me fill out now when I go for my breast surveillance is a form where they ask you, if you are diagnosed, you know, how will you pay? And then it's like the scale. I have money to pay for it. I have access to money to pay for it. I have no money to pay for it. I have some money.
Which is a bit invasive because I feel that. And I,
it's a bit
realize,
prejudicial. Yes.
I think it is prejudicial, but it is common practice. But how is that?
Because
limiting?
I feel like when I see something like that, I feel like, well, is that going to determine the kind of care you're going to give me? You mean you're not going to give me the best care if I say that I don't have the money to pay for it?
No, like, absolutely. I mean, think of it as your body. Think of your body as a car, and think of it like, when do you take it to a garage for common stuff? When do you take it to the dealership? When do you make a decision that, hey, I'm not going to fix that? All those decisions have to be made. But you make them as a consumer, and you really do, you know, do a best practice. Now, your body's not exactly a car. You can't just trade it in. You can't just trade it in. But, you know, when it comes to care, you know, that level of, okay, let me just go to an urgent health
clinic.
But
you can customize it. Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ned.
I can go to an urgent care clinic. And why would I go? I got a sore throat. It feels like I got the flu or I sprained my ankle or something like that. There you go to the urgent care. But if you're having chronic pain, if you're having something that's recurring and all that, maybe urgent care is not the best place for you. Maybe.
But you won't know that until you go to the urgent care, and it won't make you go broke. Look, I'm not advocating for urgent care. I'm just explaining why urgent care is so popular, because all of those unknown variables are gone. You pay your fee if you have it, and then you're done, you know? And I'm just saying that, you know, some places have no hospital systems because hospitals have just been decimated by this pandemic or didn't have a lot of hospitals to begin with because they just didn't have the money. They didn't have the might. They don't have the federal backing, you know, and some places are just healthcare deserts. So in some instances, urgent care is kind of all you have, and it's the lesser evil because, and I'm not saying that medical care is evil. I'm just saying in terms of if you're looking at your budget and you need immediate care, that's not going to run you. I mean, in some instances, they're charging you hundreds of dollars for a Band-Aid at a hospital, for heaven's sake.
I get it. And with that, I think that's a good segue into our next topic, but let's take a real short break and we'll be right back.
From the Lower Nine to Uptown, Mid-City to the West Bank, we got you covered, New Orleans. WHIV 102.3 FM.
Okay, and we're back. And I know you had a bee in your bonnet to talk about managed care. So let's jump into it. First of all, I wanted to wrap up real quick and say that, you know, I'm not for or against urgent care. I'm just saying that urgent care is and is becoming the future because of its accessibility. Absolutely. And because of its affordability. Boom. Boom. Now, that said, we're going to get into managed care. Now, what is managed care, you may be asking? Managed care is a system of healthcare, such as like an HMO, Health Maintenance Organization, or PPO. I forgot what PPO means. Point and provider organization, something like that, that controls costs by placing limits on physicians' fees and by restricting the patient's choice of physicians. And so what is the goal of managed care? Goal of managed care is to control costs while maintaining quality. Providers usually receive compensation as a fixed amount per program member, and there is usually a withheld program during the plan year. What are the advantages and disadvantages of managed care? Benefits of managed care include patients having multiple options for coverage and paying lower costs for prescription drugs. Disadvantages include restrictions on where patients can get services and issues with finding referrals. So, with that said, CVS has unveiled a new health-focused retail strategy, an explicit move into primary care. CVS is planning to close 900 stores. That's roughly 10% of its footprint over the next 3 years in an effort to evolve with changing consumer buying patterns. The revamp, part of the retail drugstore's ongoing strategy, includes new store formats with a stronger focus on healthcare, including locations for primary care delivery. The shutdowns will begin next spring. CVS will be remodeling an undisclosed number of stores to include more health services, including primary care delivery. So what do we think about this?
Well,
it's timely, huh?
I got comments on the beginning and I got some comments on the end. Actually, the CVS news is timely because it puts the urgent care, it gives you kind of like a one-stop shop in urgent care, where you have your urgent care facility.
In fact, a lot of hospitals are spinning off into that urgent care model, right, as well, because they're seeing that's where the money is.
And if you remember, Costco was spinning off into this model a long time ago. However, they hooked up with a company called Theranos, which is right now in court. And the whole model there was that Theranos claimed to have, well, if you're not familiar with the case, Theranos claimed to have these diagnostics that within
one drop of blood,
and then within an hour you would find out what exactly is wrong with you. And the truth was that they were actually shipping it somewhere else, and sometimes you'd have to wait a day or days. So it wasn't really like have a seat and we'll be right with you. So that whole one-stop ecosystem was tried and abandoned by Costco. CVS is doing a more limited basis where they're just doing the clinic and then they're doing the drug dispensary all right there.
One-stop shopping.
So you come in, you got pink eye, they give you, they diagnose you with pink eye. They
go right to their pharmacy.
You go into the pharmacy section, you get the products that's needed for you. You're out the door and it's all, it can all be done after work or on your schedule in somewhere that's accessible.
It sounds all very convenient too.
And non-threatened. You know, you're not threatened by the experience, where a hospital can be threatened. So I'm happy for that.
Well, not threatening, but intimidating, right?
Yeah. But let's look at the hierarchy of healthcare in terms of cost and effectiveness. The first level is no insurance, which to me is horrible, is awful. The next level is the urgent care model, where you go in, pay a small fee, or it's covered by some minimal insurance, and out the door you go. Number three is the managed care type of scenario that you were talking about. And let's delve a little bit deeper into that. Let's look at that definition. Do you remember the definition? Do you have that?
Of managed care?
Well, where it starts out with, we control costs.
So healthcare is a system of healthcare that controls costs by placing limits on physicians' fees and by restricting the patient's choice of physicians.
Right. But there was another sentence there, which would give you quality care.
The goal of managed care.
Yeah, the goal of managed care.
Control costs while maintaining quality.
Okay. How about providing quality while maintaining costs?
So I take it you've had previous experience with HMO?
I've had, not only have I had previous experience with HMOs, but and they weren't all that good. But I've also had previous experience with writing mission statements for corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you, they take a long time. This came from a corporation's mission statement. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say where.
Mm-hmm.
They take a long time in writing these, and they give it a lot of thought. A lot of smart people in the room.
Okay.
And when you look at how the words are layered, they control costs while providing quality health service.
While maintaining quality.
Maintaining. Not maintaining quality health service while controlling costs. So what is their number one goal?
Controlling costs.
Exactly. So they're looking at their bottom line. Every single one of these things.
Yeah, because they could easily say maintaining quality at an affordable cost.
Right.
And they don't, they're not saying that. No. Oh, okay. All right. No. I smell what you're stepping in.
Exactly. So what they're trying to do is control your costs. Make sure.
But that's a good thing. That's a good thing. Provided they can actually maintain quality.
Okay. Am I going in there to control my costs? I'm already paying a monthly fee. Usually the way that works is you pay whatever number per month.
Okay.
And you get service X.
Okay.
I'm not going in there to control my costs. I'm going in there for healthcare.
Okay.
That's
okay, Mr. Moneybags. Go ahead. I'm listening.
No, it's not Moneybags. That is priority number one.
I'm just okay, go ahead. I'm just saying that some people don't have a problem with this because you don't. Well, I don't know. I've never been part of a health maintenance organization. I've never been restricted. I pay for my health insurance, and if I'm not happy with the doctor, I go to another doctor.
Yeah, but you've got the good insurance. Let's call it the good insurance or the.
Yes, I do have. Yeah, I don't have managed care.
When you go into managed care, you can switch doctors, but you can't switch outcomes. Because they go by a select pathway.
Mm-hmm.
You have treatment protocols. You know, if you have, let's say, cholesterol.
That's one size fits all.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. There's no discussion. You go into your doctor, your cholesterol is 140. Their rules are until you hit 140, you're not going to making up the 140. The number could be whatever. But until you hit that number, you're not going to get the drug.
Mm-hmm.
You can be 139. You could be discussing diets. You could be saying, I'm eating pizza every, whatever. Yeah. Until you get to whatever, you're not going to get the cure.
That's so funny because I heard, I'm trying to remember where, I think it was Dr. Hyman's podcast where he had another doctor and he said that a patient came to him and they had their uncontrolled blood sugar and their doctor's response was, well, wait till your blood sugar gets higher.
Mm-hmm.
And then we could put you on a medication. So it wasn't like, let's control it now before it gets out of control. It was like, well, let's wait till it gets higher. So your A1C
let's wait till you're closer to
it. It's 5.9 now. Let's wait till you get to 7. And then we could put you on some medicine.
Because remember, the managed care, not only are they paying for your health care, but they're also paying for your drugs.
Right.
So you're not going to be getting the top drug. You're going to be getting whatever. You're going to be getting a lot of generics.
Okay.
The drugs are also going to be skewed in terms of cost. It's not only the
care. But most insurance does that.
Well, doctors write.
Right. Whatever. They'll write in and then the pharmacy fills it with the generic.
With the generic. But at least now you see that doctor wrote drug A.
Right.
You're getting drug B.
Right.
You can talk to the pharmacist. Sometimes there's pay, you know, there's a difference
pay differential.
In payment,
yeah.
Pay differential. You pay that.
Yeah. Which I've done that. I'm like, well,
also,
what's this?
Also,
oh, this
in a
is
lot
a generic.
Of
no,
you
no,
have
no.
To do is,
I want the brand name. How much more is that going to be? All right.
Yes. Yeah. A lot of tips too to give people out there is go on your drug site's website and they will have a section in many cases. If your coverage doesn't afford this, click on this coupon and you'll get a coupon for the drug.
Yes.
So there are options.
But, you know, most people don't
do.
Nobody does it.
But it's there.
Yeah.
It's like when you go shopping, nobody cuts the coupons, but they're there.
Right.
You know, you go to Bed Bath & Beyond.
I cut those coupons.
You cut that 20%.
I cut the 20%. I cut the $15 off. I cut the $20
off. But half
off
the people don't.
One single item.
You know, it's like, come on. If you do it for Bed Bath & Beyond, do it for your body. You know?
I agree and I understand. I'm just saying that that's just not how, and I'm not saying that people shouldn't do it. This is all very good advice. I'm just saying
it's
that.
It's not how it works, but it should be how it works.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, and then the next is like limiting options and kind of you go through a process. So you're not getting the best possible care.
I think those doctors would be insulted to hear you say that. But all right, go ahead. Now, why are you not getting the best possible care? Is it because the doctors are restricted by the rules of the HMO? Is that why the...
Well, the HMO is a corporation, okay?
Right.
And I like corporations. Yeah, I'm all pro-capitalism, you know that. That said, they work on a profit. So if you're paying, let's say, $100 a month or $500 a month, whatever the number is, it's closer to 500 probably to be in an HMO. What they're going to do is they're going to make sure that you're costing them only $400 a month.
Right.
Now, how does that benefit you? Benefits you is they're going to try and keep you healthy for as long as possible.
Right. Yeah.
How it doesn't benefit you as you progress from healthy to unhealthy.
Yeah.
They may ignore a few things to keep you on the healthy side of the bracket.
Or if you say, look, I want a second opinion because I don't agree with you, Dr. So-and-so. They give you a very hard time to switch to another provider.
Right. So they have ratings of patients and all that. And they don't turn away patients that aren't healthy by any means. And, you know, the healthy patients do subsidize those. And that's kind of how it works. But doctors are incentivized to keep you in green. Now, a lot of times they keep you in green by keeping you in green. Helping you stay healthy, having you keep diets. There are other instances that I've noticed where symptoms are ignored, as you were saying before. Well, let's give it some time. Well, let's do this. You know, let's wait until you're really dead, and then we'll give you this. Because now you've gone from a profitable patient to an unprofitable patient. And the doctor's almost like a corporate employee. They're incentivized in terms of their patient.
They're incentivized. So given the example that I just gave, they're incentivized to... Say, well, let's wait till your blood sugar, your A1C gets up to from pre-diabetic to diabetic so that we can give you metformin. They're incentivized to do that?
Incentivized. There's implicit incentivization and explicit incentivization. Explicit is if they come in and they don't do this, blah, 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 don't give it to them. You know, we've all seen the movie Rainmaker, I think was a classic where...
Oh, the John Grisham movie.
Yes. Yeah, a story where people are incentivized to turn you down, even though, you know, that does happen in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But let's not assume the worst in humanity.
Right.
I don't believe that anywhere in some of these bigger HMOs, there's a little manual that says, you know, once they're in this danger zone or yellow zone, keep them there for as long as possible.
But they might have a physician who's looking at these claims. I mean, I don't know if HMOs have claims, but looking at this and saying, no, this doesn't really meet the threshold. And they're incentivized to keep costs down.
Right.
So they may ignore something.
Well, what's happening is...
On behalf of the company. Well,
what happens is, now let's look at where there's where it's not really there, but it's kind of implied. If you keep your patient population healthy, you get a bigger incentive. You're the doctor that has 89% of their patients good, healthy, while Dr. B has 80%. So you might get bigger bonuses. You might get bigger status. However it is that it's done, there is a reward.
And you might have more patients pushed in your direction.
Right. There's a reward there somehow, okay. Whether it's status, bonus, money, prestige, whatever, okay. However that is, you're rewarded somehow.
Okay.
So you're now being rewarded to not have people in that category. So if you have the power to decide who gets in that category or not, that's a lot of, you know, that puts you in a conflict of interest space.
Yes,
and
that's true.
And not all people are gonna think that way. A lot of people always think in terms of their self-interest. So the physician here has a self-interest. And not only the physician, but the organization has a self-interest to not provide you this care. And they don't view it that way. But start looking at their missions. You know, if we go back and reread the mission and then say, wait a minute, this is all about cost. This is all about managing costs and doing this and herding people as if we're cattle. that's not the process that I want. You know, that's what I can get.
Okay, but I just don't, I guess what I just don't see the problem with saving money. Are you saying that they're saving? So if the argument is that they're saving money at the expense of quality of care, then yes, that's problematic. But given the rise in costs of medicine today and all this surprise billing and this out of control, spending, I just don't really see a huge problem with a health maintenance organization saying, you know what, we're going to keep our costs down. We're not going to have these doctors charging us an arm and a leg for stuff and sending us these crazy ICD-9 codes for stuff that's basic.
Okay, but, you know, do you consider yourself basic? I mean, for a young person who's relatively healthy, that's not experiencing this, that's just starting out in their earning careers, this may make sense.
Right. Yeah. If you're 20 something and you're relatively healthy, but also given where we are with the rise in all these health problems, we're seeing young people with fatty livers now.
Okay.
We're seeing young people with colorectal cancers now. We're seeing young people with their lungs shredded from vaping. Thank you. So we're seeing young people come in with a lot of problems that they weren't coming in for 10, 20 years ago. So now how does an HMO, adjust to that?
Well, by ignoring it or raising everybody's cost by a dollar. Now, you know, eventually they will raise the cost because they're there to make a profit. So whatever their profit margin is, 5, 10, 20%, That is coming out one end. What comes out the other end is how much is spent on health costs, and then how do they recognize you and how do they treat you? You know, to withhold treatment until you're at a more critical stage or more, let's not call it critical, but call it acute.
Yeah.
Because they don't wait until you're critical, but they do wait a lot of times, I feel, until it's a more acute stage.
Yeah.
And that's where I say, you know, are we settling and creating a nation of second rate? And already we're seeing, as we move more into this managed care,
we're seeing more health outcomes that are not great.
Our health outcomes are not as optimal as they are in the rest of the world.
Right.
And in the rest of the world, this HMO model is a little different.
Mm.
That HMO model that the rest of the world does is not as profit oriented as it is in the United States. And it's funded by other sources of income that I'm not going to get into.
We're not going to get
geopolitical,
into
like where the gold mine is,
please not.
Where the diamonds are and all that. So you know, in terms of how we fund things and how we work for things, an HMO to me is a good system, but only
it can be a good system.
But buyer beware.
Right.
Realize what the limitations are. Realize when it's time to start moving on from an HMO and realize what their goals are and to stand up for your rights. Because somewhere in there, there's the argument scene. So if your doctor, if you feel you need this medication, your doctor says no, time to fight it.
Yeah, but it sounds like you can't really fight it in an HMO system. You have to leave the HMO, pay ridiculous monthly fee premium like I'm doing, and have your own insurance. Bottom line, people, is though you this is something that you should be aware of. This is something that you need to keep your eye on if you have insurance. And if you don't have insurance, you should start kind of looking around to see what insurance options are available to you and what's going to work best for you. Because let me tell you, healthcare is expensive. Taking care of yourself is not as expensive as healthcare. Healthcare is a mother sucker. So remember, nobody's going to look after your health the way you're going to look after your health. Nobody. All right. Okay. That's all the time we have today.
All righty.
We're going to say goodbye and thank you so much and bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Urban Health Weekly today. I hope you'll join me and my friends next week so you can stay informed and inspired to take control of your health. See you next time.